And so we will know then whether it is Nick Bockwinkle or Curt Hennig or exactly who is the heavyweight champion of the world of the AWA.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
AWA Championship Wrestling. The AWA presents the greatest stars in professional wrestling, bringing you the best in mat action.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 67. Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson. And today, be going back to the AWA, this time from May 9th, 1987, the ESPN show that they would do. And yes, I am going to address your questions why I would do another AWA show when I just did one four shows ago. But believe me, I'm going to get into detail on that, you know, in due time. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, particularly if you have complaints about me doing another AWA show. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GFAllentownPod. And you are probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon, where you can help the Place to Be Nation with site costs through your purchases. A portion is kicked back. You know the whole deal. I mean, that's kind of on every wrestling podcast. But I do encourage you to use placetobenation.com/Amazon, because I did the other day, because I had an unfortunate random thing happen to me where you get a song stuck in your head for absolutely no reason. And in this case, it's the song Dark Star from Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I think it's off the CSN album from, I want to say, 1977. And it's not a song that I've listened to very often. I think it was implanted in my brain on Sirius XM about 10 days ago, and then all of a sudden it just came roaring back. And I have no idea why, but I bought a whole bunch of music once again, you know, through the, you know, $1.29.99, because really iTunes, I forget my password there all the time, so it's too much of a pain in the ass to actually go through Apple Music and all that. So as for my weekend, I'm feeling moderately under the weather. I do hope that as I record this, it is a Monday afternoon, as tonight I will be taping along with Scott Criscolo and JT Rosero the latest episode of the Place to Be podcast, which you can find on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, covering Saturday night's main event from March 12th, 1988. Should be a fun one there. That is the one with Harley Race going through the table against Hulk Hogan. So that is definitely the highlight of that show. But I am feeling a little under the weather, and you can always tell that I'm not feeling great when, well, first of all, I'm cranky, but that really makes no indication as to how I feel or not, because I pretty much am like that all the time. When I bust out the green tea in large quantities, that's usually a sign that something is amiss with me. Either my voice is all screwed up or whatever. It's definitely not allergies. I just feel lethargic. And it's probably because on Saturday, I went to a baseball game up in New Hampshire again, just like I did the last time I did an AWA show. Except this one was a doubleheader that I went to by myself because I'm a complete weirdo. I stayed for both complete games of the doubleheader, even when it started raining and they didn't have to bring out the tarp or anything. But I sat there through the entire thing. Hartford won the first game. New Hampshire won the second game. It is what it is. I did not go back this afternoon as planned. Instead, I laid around and watched the MLB channel as I was preparing for the podcast. I actually took most of my notes during the Celtics-Cavaliers Game 7 the other night, in which LeBron did it again. He's truly remarkable. And by the way, don't listen to any media people like that guy whose name rhymes with Chip Kalis. I block him because I don't want anybody retweeting his garbage into my feed. The guy is remarkable. He's won 24 consecutive series in the Eastern Conference. Does he always win the NBA Finals? No, but it's not very often that he actually has the better team. I think really the only time that he had the better team and lost was probably 2011 against Dallas. But enough basketball. I took my notes for this show, and before I get into that, the opening TV theme that you hear at the beginning today is ALF. So, this is a request from the voice of Greetings from Allentown, Keith Langston. And if you recall, the closing theme on ALF featured a guy taking a bump off a roof into the bushes. It's the one where you can hear, pretty sure I was the right age to enjoy ALF. I think it came on the air when I was 7, and it got canceled when I was 10. And yes, in fact, it got canceled despite the last episode that aired in March of 1990 ending with a to-be-continued cliffhanger. And a lot of people just assumed that ALF ended up dying or something, but that really didn't happen. They just canceled the show for whatever reason, but
ALF Pogs! Remember ALF? He's back! In pod form.
All right, thank you, Milhouse. I've done enough Zabisco-like stalling here before I get into the heart of the episode here. So why don't I just interview myself as to, I mean, somebody else would probably ask these same questions of me, you know, with regards to AWA from May of 1987. Why would you do that? Why would you do that, Pete? What? Why? Well, let me tell you something. It's because it is the Major League of Professional Wrestling. I don't mean like the movie Major League.
Look at this fucking guy.
Although maybe in retrospect, that is exactly what Vern Gagne was going for with some of his insane booking decisions over the years. With screw job finishes and letting guys walk out the door that he maybe could have hung on to. I mean, you know, it could be the Major League of Professional Wrestling if you put it that way. All right. No, really. Why would you do another AWA show at this point? Well, it's after Super Clash 2. It's one of the super shows that you can find on the WWE Network if you're willing to sit through 3 hours of AWA action. And I thought I always get it confused with Super Clash 3. I always call that 3 because of WrestleMania 3 being right before it. And it's actually Super Clash 2. And you got Superfly Jimmy Snuka and Russ Francis in the main event at the end of the show. We got Henning and Bockwinkel. There's a lot of controversy coming out of that show, don't you know? No, really. Why would you do another AWA show at this point in time? You literally just did one from the year before. There's not a huge audience out there for the AWA. I mean, what the hell is your problem? Okay, fine. I got drunk on a Tuesday and I watched the video on YouTube. All right, so yes, that is exactly what happened. It is Tuesday night. I don't know what I was watching earlier in the evening, but 11 o'clock, I helped myself out to a bourbon, and I put on this show, and for whatever reason, I started laughing uncontrollably at various points. Now, that might have been the alcohol talking. I don't know. It's a dangerous way to pick a show because I only remembered some of it going back. I do remember that there is exactly one set of commercials on this show, which considering that it's ESPN is a little odd, but I'm going to explain that when I get to that point. But if you're going to pick a spot in AWA history, you would probably pick something like this where something happened, because on their week-to-week TV, after you get past 84 and 85, not very much is happening. Not that they were booking hot angles back then either. But, you know, when I think about it, I should do an AWA show from 1983, and I do have one in the queue somewhere. I know the graphic has a picture of Jerry Blackwell in the Sheik getup alongside Sheik Adnan LKC. And, yeah, I'll get there at some point. In many ways, the AWA is actually, and you know me, I love baseball, as I've already established by going to a doubleheader by myself on a Saturday. They are kind of like the Baltimore Orioles of wrestling promotions. They slid downhill really, really quickly. Apparently, I like watching it for some reason. And both of them peaked in 1983, in all likelihood. So really, that's the kind of similarity they have there. Now, this show is taped at the Showboat in Las Vegas. However, the taping is definitely before the Super Clash 2 show. It's very hard to see actual dates of results with some of the AWA TV tapings in Las Vegas, although there is a Sherry Martel match on this show that I was able to pinpoint to March of 87, but that's because they point out that it had been taped a lot earlier, so I'm going to assume that this taping was done in April of 87 at the Showboat in Las Vegas. And that casino, and I may have gone over this previously, it eventually became a casino called Castaways that ended up closing in late January of 2004. It's kind of interesting because I was actually living in Las Vegas at the time, but I don't remember in the least going to that casino or driving by that casino or anything. It's actually just east of downtown, and you can see it on a Google map. Not the building, mind you, but a giant empty triangle, which in Las Vegas, sometimes those don't last very long. You would think that that would get developed at some point. However, Station Casinos actually owns the plot, and they actually own, kind of grandfathered in, a casino license for the property. And to get around a loophole, in order to keep that license active while they figure out what to do with the property, if they can eventually develop it or something, they actually roll a portable casino on the site every so often, because you have to have a casino on site for, I think it's 8 hours, a minimum of 8 hours every 2 years. So for one, like, 9-to-5 shift, probably at night, given how hot Las Vegas can be much of the year, it's kind of a weird thing where they kind of roll in a casino like it's a carnival or something, and then they roll it back out in order to meet this loophole. So, you know, there's a little bit of Las Vegas real estate. You know, I could have just said that I'm doing this because the Las Vegas Golden Knights, or the Vegas Golden Knights, is in the Stanley Cup final, but that didn't register with me until I had already decided to do the show. That series between Vegas and Washington is certainly the 2003 Peter Winson Classic, because that was when I moved from Washington, where I was a Capital season ticket holder for 2 years, and moved to Vegas in October of 2003. So it's just so weird. I want to travel back in time to tell myself this from 15 years ago. And then, you know, also maybe give a few more rejoinders to my younger self. But anyway, we do have some interesting bouts on the show, leading off with Curt Hennig, the would-be AWA World Heavyweight Champion, although that is clearly in dispute at this time. And he faces a very interesting enhancement opponent on this show. You have the team of Super Ninja and Mr. Saito, who are kind of handled, I guess, by Larry Zbysko. They are in tag team action later on in the show. As I mentioned, Sherry Martel has a match that was taped earlier than some of these shows. We also get to see the original gangsta himself, Nick Bockwinkel, really winding down his career in the AWA, as he would be in the WWF as an announcer and as an agent by later in 1987. His retirement would happen just a few months down the line. And then finally, we have a Midnight Rockers match. So instead of rapping on this show, they are actually in the ring performing, as they are the AWA Tag Team Champions at this time. So with all that in mind, let's just jump right into the show. We must live. Love Steve Winwood, because his career now spans 50 years. He joined the Spencer Davis Group at like the age of 14 in the mid-60s and did vocals on Gimme Some Lovin'. And then 86 and 87, he does Back in the High Life, releases that album, which goes top 10 in the United States, wins Record of the Year at the Grammys. This, The Finer Things, actually was the second biggest hit on the album, and I'm actually looking at that vinyl album on my wall right now. So our host for AWA is Larry Nelson. And I have to issue a correction from last time. Once again, I screwed up a name and got him confused with something else. I had said that Larry Nelson was the golfer who won the 1987 Masters. That is not true. That is actually Larry Mize. Larry Nelson did win a different major in 1987. He won the PGA Championship, which is kind of the least of the four golf majors. He also won it in 1981, but he did win the U.S. Open in 1983. So he's rather accomplished, certainly a hell of a lot more accomplished than this Larry Nelson is as an announcer. I'm not particularly fond because he doesn't really do a lot of things well. And here he is awarding a fan of the week as a fan wrote to them from Scotland. And what did they end up winning? It was a game of Ninja Star Wars. More on that in a second. And you're supposed to write to the Minneapolis Wrestling Club, and they give the address there. And I actually looked up what's going on with that land. It is actually for sale right now. It is just west of downtown Minneapolis. It is 1.41 acres. And the asking price is $1.25 million. So no thank you there. It's right on like, it's like a, has a frontage road on the interstate. So no thanks. That's a little bit out of my price range. So this game, Ninja Star Wars, is actually how Eric Bischoff gets in the door in professional wrestling industry. And it's rather fascinating how that worked out. Apparently, it was in conjunction with Sonny Ono, of all people, who came to Vern and said, hey, can we plug this game on your show? So they would give it to the fan of the week. And Sonny Ono, he mentioned this in some sort of interview in the last couple of years, says, I created this game, an actual physical game called Ninja Star Wars. It was a Velcro vest with Velcro stars and a headband. I showed this idea to Eric, and he tells me, Sonny, we have to sell this on television. Eric then gets a hold of the AWA, which was a syndicated program on ESPN. So Eric has a meeting with Vern and works out a deal to advertise Ninja Star Wars with their program, and that was Eric's introduction into professional wrestling. So love him or hate him, that's how he ends up here. And that is how he ends up having an 83 weeks podcast that I haven't listened to yet. I've heard mixed reviews on that. I'm not sure that there's been an issue that they've talked about yet that has really tickled my fancy. So we get an interruption here from the Super Ninja, who just comes into frame. I don't know if he's offended by the name of the game.
That's the name of the game.
There are two things that I immediately notice here. One of which is that Larry Nelson's tie is way too short for how tall he is or whatever. It kind of falls short of his belly button, and it's noticeably short. I know that, you know, these days Donald Trump wears the extra long tie, clearly because he has some sort of insecurity about what's going on between his legs, I would imagine. But you can wear an ultra long or ultra short. Larry Nelson, on the other end of the spectrum here, I'm not speculating on what that might mean, but he's got to make it a little bit longer, I think. But that's small potatoes, and to use a Trumpism from the USFL 30 for 30, is Super Ninja comes into screen and he throws up his hands like he's doing, you know, karate moves or some such nonsense. And holy shit, he's got fucking swastikas on his armband. In 1987, he's wearing fucking swastikas on ESPN. What the hell is going on with that? How the hell did that pass muster? I'm going to have to post it on the Twitter or wherever, because this blew my fucking mind, the fact that I saw this and that it got through. I mean, it's not like, oh, swastikas were okay in 1987. It's not like you can lay back and say that. No, they were not okay in 1987. I mean, what the hell is going on here? I mean, it absolutely makes me crazy. And to stay on the dumb side here, Larry closes out the segment by throwing it to himself.
Vicki Anderson, congratulations! Let's go to the ring! Let's go to the ring to me!
Host of the show, ring announcer. I was afraid he was going to be play-by-play, but luckily we have somebody else. A little bit of Larry Nelson goes a long way. That's what my grandpa used to say. And this guy ain't even that good. At least in old-timey Vince McMahon, at least I could deal with him when he's on every single show, doing update segments, doing play-by-play, and all that. At least he wasn't doing the ring announcing. At least we got Lou McHugh.
First of all, from Allentown, Pennsylvania, weighing in at 270 pounds, he is Jerry Saganovich.
Why, yes, that is a young Jerry Sags using his real name, his full name, probably for the best to just go by Sags because it sounds good as a nickname and it just comes off a lot better. It's easier to say. We'll get to him in a second. As I said, I'm not sure when this is taped. It's certainly before Super Clash 2, as Henning does get cheered, as he was a babyface, up to the point in which he wins the world title. Now, his story is that he had verbally agreed to join the World Wrestling Federation in the spring of 1987. And that's an interesting, to borrow from the Our Vantage Point podcast, because they've done a segment like this, the butterfly effect of Curt Hennig making the jump over. First of all, you have to decide, is he going to be a face or a heel in WWF in 1987? Odds are you think he would be a heel, but I tend to think that he might have been better off starting at least as a babyface, and I'll get to that in a second. Who beats Nick Bockwinkel for the AWA title eventually if Curt Hennig takes off and he doesn't win the title? I'm thinking that it goes directly from Bockwinkel to Jerry Lawler, and they just skip over Curt Hennig, or they could just go right to Larry Zbysko and do something like that, but I don't know if... There's a reason why they went to Lawler before Larry Zbysko. Perhaps the partnership with other promotions gets sped up. Who knows? But what happens to Hennig in 87? Did they have Mr. Perfect set for him in that year if he had made the jump over? Supposedly, Pat Patterson had it thought up for him for a long time leading up, you know, just knowing his athleticism and all that. The reason why I think that he would have been best sliding in as a babyface at the mid-card IC title level after you build him up a little bit, I think he's a perfect guy to maybe take Ricky Steamboat's spot at some point, where perhaps he could feud with Honky at some point. Although Savage, you know, it's kind of hard to argue against turning him babyface as well. I do see the argument where you could bring him in as a heel and put him in the Heenan family. The problem with that is things are starting to get a little bit crowded there. Hercules, Harley Race is getting a bit of a push. Rick Rude was on his way in. So there's not as much room for him there as a heel. And I just don't see him with Slick or Jimmy Hart. That just doesn't really strike me as a fit. I think as a babyface, if you build him slowly, perhaps you could, you know, set him up to the point where maybe he replaces Tom Zenk in the Can-Am connection. And he teams with Rick Martel, and they go on and actually win the titles rather than Strikeforce, as it turned out. So maybe Tito Santana was the biggest winner out of all this, but there's a lot of permutations that would have, you know, had to happen to kind of get to that point. In retrospect, I understand why they did the finish conditionally the way they did, but the problem with it is the AWA had done so many screwy finishes with their world title over the years that it was just going to annoy people and drive them away the way it was going. In fact, they probably caught a break that Hennig stuck around, because if he did end up leaving and the title goes back to Bockwinkel, I think that would have antagonized people a little bit more, even though Nick Bockwinkel is the original gangster. And, you know, he was kind of as the respected legend of the promotion at that point. Now, as for Jerry Sags, he had started as an enhancement guy in late 86, around the October time period, and then into 87, the Nasty Boys form. And the fun thing about that team with Brian Knobbs is that they were pals as kids. I kind of like that. Rather than just like two guys thrown together who don't know each other, I love the fact that these two guys actually go all the way back to time as kids. And they were working in the AWA and then later in Florida. And it kind of made me think, are they the last great? Well, maybe great is overstating it. But they were a tag team developed out of the territory system. And they might be the last one. There may be a few more after that. One thing about the Nasty Boys that I've always liked is that they would zig when other teams would zag. You know, people were wearing bright colors around that time. And they're wearing all black. So is kind of an interesting look for them, and something that actually came into style much more later in the 90s, unfortunately, after they had stopped teaming together with the retirement of Jerry Sags. He's nominally a heel here because, as I said, Henning is still a babyface, not yet adopting the cool Kurt Henning persona. I'm sure they stayed up all night thinking of that one, but I guess alliteration or whatever. So there, this is something that's going to bug me throughout the show, and it is kind of a running theme here at the Showboat, is the seats open in the front row opposite the hard camera. It's not a good look at all. I mean, any sensible wrestling promotion, but this is the AWA we're talking about, we're not talking about a sensible wrestling promotion, would have seat fillers from the back. You know, why don't you come on up and sit in the front? Maybe kids or something like that. Who knows? Somebody who might be actually into it, because even the people who are there are really just, like, there's a woman wearing a dress there for every one of these matches, and she just does not give a shit. So it's not a good look. And we learn early in this match why Jerry Sags would go on to wear a shirt in his career when he takes it off. And thank God that he wore a shirt for his in-ring work for the rest of his career, for the good of the nation. So maybe give Sags some kind of medal on that. Our commentary team here is Rod Trongard, a staple of the AWA around this time, would later show up doing WWF house shows for much of 1988, and football player Russ Francis, who actually is one of the greatest tight ends in the history of pro football. At that time, he's certainly top two or three in the NFL, right up there with Kellen Winslow and all those guys. Is he better than Jay Saldy is doing world-class championship wrestling as an announcer? Well, I don't know, but yes. And as a tight end, I can certainly say yes, because Saldy was a backup for the Cowboys, and Russ Francis, as I said, one of the best tight ends in football with the San Francisco 49ers at that time, and before that with the New England Patriots. And they describe the Kurt Henning, Nick Bockwinkel saga, which is unresolved. I'm going to leave that as a cliffhanger. And as to the match here, we get an exchange of hammerlocks, and Saganovich, I'm going to really have trouble saying his full name, so I'm probably just going to call him Sags from now on. He reaches the ropes, and we get more chain wrestling, and Henning just kind of slaps him, so maybe a glimpse at that heel character to come. Then another hammerlock is lucked in by Henning, and you get a boring chant by one guy. And somebody asked when boring chants started in pro wrestling, and maybe I addressed this before, but 1986 seems to be the year where people just decided they just did not care anymore and were going to shout boring and be disrespectful and basically let their voice be heard when they were at a live event. A side headlock, but then Sags ends up getting in actually a bit of offense on Henning, who is going to be their world champion very shortly. Russ Francis then goes into that cliche, like, oh boy, I thought football was tough, but boy, these wrestlers, like, oh, all right, shut up, Russ. You're not worse than Saldy, but don't get on my nerves here, or I'll demote you so quickly. Henning reverses a whip to the corner, and it looks like he's turning up the aggressiveness a little bit to get this thing over with in accordance with his new heel character that is going to be rolled out very soon. A bell ringer by Kurt, where he kind of puts Sags' head between his legs like he's going for a pile driver, but instead just jumps up and down. One of those classic 1980s moves that you never really saw after about 1995 or anything like that. Rake to the eyes by Sags, and Russ Francis, for whatever reason, because apparently, even though he was in the WrestleMania 2 Battle Royal a year earlier, has no idea of the rules of wrestling and asks if you can do that.
Rakes the eyes of Kurt Henning.
Is that fair here?
Not the flare.
Is it fair?
You can't do that in the NFL. I just wondered whether you could do that here.
Pretty tough to get to you guys in the NFL with the bird cages that you wear.
It's amazing they do, believe me, they do.
Even though Francis kind of comes off sounding a little dumb there, the NFL that he played in from 1975 to 1988 was a completely different animal. I mean, there was eye gouging, there was clotheslines, horse collar tackles. I mean, that lasted up until 2004. But he played in a completely different era for the NFL. I don't know. I always say that the modern game kind of started in 1994 with the two-point conversion and when they changed the kickoff rules, but it was certainly a hell of a lot more rough and tumble in his day. And there also was not as much of a face mask back then. A lot of guys would just wear like the little two bars on there, so you could get to the eyes there. I don't know why I'm feeling the need to defend Russ Francis so much. Maybe it's because he is a former New England Patriot and probably should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I mean, as I said, he was one of the two or three best tight ends during his time in the NFL. And Henning gets slammed in a two count for sacks, but then Kurt turns things up, lands a running drop kick. So not the standing drop kick that Henning was so good at, but this one catches him on the run off an Irish whip, follows up with a clothesline, as we hear in the background that this match has gone 5 minutes, and I'm scratching my head that this enhancement guy, Saganovich, gets 5 minutes in a 10-minute time limit match with Henning. I mean, why not just have Henning just kill this guy right away and maybe use promo time or whatever, but maybe they just needed to fill things out. There was not a lot of guys in the promotion at this point. A lot of them had left, and he finishes him off with the cradle suplex. Yes, he was doing the perfect plex before the WWF, and he picks up the 1-2-3 there. As I said, this was way too long, I think, you know, 5.5 minutes. This is your champ, at the very least, or a top two guy. And yes, I know he's going out the door, but I don't think anybody's going to tune into the WWF and say, well, I can't take this Kurt Henning guy seriously because some jobber took him 5.5 minutes. So I don't understand what the point of this was. And they go to the top contenders for Bockwinkel's AWA title. And they list the top five, so they don't do a full top 10. So Jim Ross, if he's watching, doesn't fully get it up. He only gets a semi on this one. Henning, of course, is number one. Number two, Superfly Jimmy Snuka, which tells you everything you need to know about the AWA in 1987. Colonel De Beers, the racist South African apartheid guy, is number three. Number four is Super Ninja, who I don't know if I'll call him racist per se, but who the hell wears a swastika on television in 1987? I know that he's supposed to be Japanese and all that, but for the love of God, why are you allowing swastikas on television in the 80s? And number five is Mr. Magnificent. It didn't ring a bell right away, but that is Kevin Kelly. No, not the one that you're going to hear in just a second, but yes, that is Nails. And Christ, compare that top five contenders for their world title to what was going on in the World Wrestling Federation or in Jim Crockett Promotions.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Rod Trongard is with Larry Zbysko in an empty cow palace. And no, this is not during the show. It wasn't that empty. They did draw 2,800 to Super Clash 2, which is certainly below expectations, but at the very least, the crowd was into it at times, so I'll give them credit there. And Rod Trongard is a man who likes to wear sunglasses indoors a lot. I don't know if he's a Corey Hart fan or whatever, and he wears them at night. Occasionally, I'll wear my sunglasses indoors at work, mainly when I'm feeling particularly antisocial, especially these days where I'm interviewing for other places and, you know, kind of want to go somewhere else. But Rod Trongard, we actually see him without his sunglasses on later, and whew, yeah, put those sunglasses back on, Rod, because they didn't have eye tucks back then, or at least Rod Trongard was not into getting one of those. Now, Larry Zbysko, for his part, he looks very much to me like Jim Belushi, and sometimes Jim Belushi could be a little annoying, because at times, it seemed like he was piggybacking on his late brother's fame, you know, with the Blues Brothers 2000. You know, he's also on Saturday Night Live in the mid-80s, but, you know, to much less fanfare than John Belushi, who had passed away in 1982. He was always just kind of a Chicago gadfly also. Like, oh, I'm a big Cubs fan. It's like, great, that's wonderful. Now nobody gives a crap about you. You won your World Series. Shut the hell up. But Jim Belushi, I've come to accept him. You know, I've seen a couple of episodes of According to Jim, and maybe it's just because one of the writers on that show was one of the two guys from the podcast Daves of Thunder that I mentioned a few weeks ago. Maybe I have a soft spot for it. But Zbyszko looking a lot like Jim Belushi kind of cracks me up. So I'm going to call this interview segment According to Larry, as he discusses his involvement in the finish of the Curt Hennig-Nick Bockwinkel match at Super Clash 2.
Even the referee himself, Gary DeRuscia, admitted on television, as far as he was concerned, Nick Bockwinkel lost. The man was counted down right in front of Stanley Blackburn, members of the championship committee, myself, fans, the whole world saw Bockwinkel on his back. 1, 2, 3, period. You know what the big controversy is? Stanley Blackburn, all his brain power, is running around trying to figure out why I would have 50, 60 cents in my pocket. Now you figure that one out.
Larry makes a few points in his defense, but I think it's a little flawed because you could see that it was well more than 50 or 60 cents that he had flying around after Hennig hit Bockwinkel with the roll of coins. It was clearly a roll of coins. I mean, you're not going to bring loose change and put it in the guy's hand. I mean, that's a little much. You'd probably want to use a roll of quarters, which would be $10. You wouldn't want to use a roll of dimes because, you know, those are fairly light, and I think it would only be $4 or $5, I think, because you could put 50 dimes in a roll. The only reason why I know that there's 40 quarters in a roll of quarters is from my video arcade days of the late 80s, with 87 being one of those prime years. So, there's also the fact that, you know, they tape the show, the AWA show. Now, granted, he's in San Francisco, but they tape in a casino, and back then they didn't have the little certificates that would print out of the machine, so maybe Larry just didn't have his little cup or whatever to carry around his change from the casinos. But since he's in San Francisco, you know, having been there 3 years ago, there is a substantial homeless population, and maybe Larry, you know, even though he's a heel, is, you know, feeling giving or whatever and wanted to have change available to give out to the homeless. I mean, maybe I'll buy that. And my God, I might be delusional here, but yeah. And then they go into the deal of Larry that he makes with Curt Hennig, which reminds me very much of the Macho Man Randy Savage at the 91 Royal Rumble with the Ultimate Warrior Sergeant Slaughter match. So this is something that actually the AWA did and then the WWF sort of copied. But of course, they actually let that finish stand and create the Warrior Savage match at WrestleMania 7. So very similar in terms of storyline there.
Now, the only thing I got disgusted with is I'm watching Bockwinkel. I'm watching Stanley Blackburn turn his head. I'm watching the referee miss the things that Bockwinkel should have been disqualified for Pete's sakes. You saw it, Rod. I went up there and I told the kid, I said, hey, go for it. The world could be yours. You know, do it. It's your guts. This is what, you know, this kid's been training for. And what happened? The same thing that's been happening to me for the last few years. I've been whitewashed, sidestepped, loopholed, and I am going to make sure one way or the
and
other,
so the
Nick Bockwinkel is not the heavyweight champion
Larry
of the
Zbyszko.
World.
Larry Zbyszko, we'll find out shortly.
All right, that little noise at the end, which was on every single sports channel in the late 80s on cable, usually when they would go to commercial, I think it had something to do with, I don't know, the systems at the time. It's never really been properly explained to me, and I don't even know how I would do a Google search to find out what the hell that noise was. But there's a flaw in Larry's plan here, giving Curt the coins to knock out Bockwinkel, and it's that, put on the kayfabe hat, he's turning Curt Hennig heel by doing this, and he's a heel himself. And it's not like he's seen a lot of heel versus heel matches in the AWA leading up to this. You're going to have a traditional heel versus babyface matchup. So now he wants a title match. He thinks just because a guy made a promise to give him a title match that somehow is going to be kept. But now Henning's a heel. They're made to break promises like that. So really kind of a dangerous game that Larry Z is playing. He's not playing his best game of chess.
Ooh, you brought me a nacho hat.
Thanks, Ned.
Nacho, nacho man. I want to be a nacho man.
In our next bout, we have Nacho Barrera, who, looking at him, he had more than his fair share of nachos. He kind of took the nachos that had more cheese and more of the beef or chili on them and didn't let anybody else have any of the guac, it would seem, just based on his body type. He had been an enhancement talent in the AWA since the mid-70s, so he had been around for quite some time, and he has one of those amusing cage match records of 0 wins and 103 losses. And I don't feel like going through to see if he ever won a match, but I would highly doubt it. But he is paired with somebody who did win matches on occasion later in the decade, Jake Milliman. 1990 AWA's answer to Daniel Bryan. I didn't say it was a good answer. I'm just saying it was an answer to what Daniel Bryan would be in 2013 and 14. They are taking on the Japanese team of the super racist Super Ninja and Mr. Saito. And they are accompanied by Larry Zbysko. And it's funny to see Saito and Larry together, considering that the last AWA title change would occur between those two swapping the belts. Larry would lose it to Saito, and then would eventually win it back at the unaired Super Clash 4. Saito, he had gone to jail just like Ken Patera did, although his was more for abusing the police who came to get Patera. And his 87 is a lot more interesting than Kenny's was. As later in the year, in October, he had the island match against Antonio Inoki, where they had basically a death match on an island that went a couple of hours. Now, I don't know how you would shoot such a match. I looked for it briefly to see if I could find it. I mean, I wouldn't have time to watch the entire thing. Would it be shot like the King of the Road match and uncensored? Like, how does it go? Do they just find one spot on the island? They would have to move around, I would guess. That's one of the questions that really kind of, I don't know. Maybe one of the Japan wrestling podcasts on the Pro Wrestling Only feed might provide me the answer to that. So Super Ninja, despite the swastikas on his arms, is Shinji Takano, who is here on a learning excursion. I don't know if he thought he was in some sort of time warp in Nazi Germany with the swastikas, but that is always kind of a fun concept. Like, I saw it in the 1981 All-Star Wrestling episode at WWF, that with Yatsu wrestling in the WWF at that time. It's kind of like a semester abroad for wrestlers. I never really had much of an interest in doing that for whatever reasons. Maybe if I didn't buy Bruins season tickets when I was in college, I would have done that. I was probably more interested in the semester in Washington because I was very much into politics, but that would not have been a good fit. I don't picture me as one of the people on Veep because I would just grow to hate everybody, which, you know, is probably the case now. But they are the number one contenders to the tag belts, Saito and Super Ninja. But of course, this being the AWA, even though they're the number one contenders, when they do the title change later in May, of course it would go to Boris Zukov and Soldat Usunov. I mean, why would you give it to the Japanese guys who might take off and go back to Japan, as both of them surely would? At this time, I'm looking at the front row again, and there are, once again, 7 empty seats in the front row, and doing nothing to fill those, no seat fillers or anything. And Saito manhandles Nacho. Well, I've manhandled my share of nachos in my day. And by manhandles, I mean, he just works him over and then finishes up with a Fujiwara armbar. And then Ninja gets in, and then they do the exchange where Milliman gets a tag in. And Russ Francis, he very peculiar here. He calls for 4 or 5 referees for tag matches. It's like he's listened to Gorilla Monsoon call for 2 referees in tag matches and has just decided to take it to the next level and make it like a football game. Like having like the side judge, the field judge, you have your referee, you have your umpire and all that. I think there are 7 or 8 officials now in NFL games. It's Now, Nacho, I did make fun of him for eating too much, but he does look like an Adonis out there. Unfortunately, it's Adrian Adonis, because his body shape is very similar to the adorable one and how he was blowing up like crazy. He turned up in the AWA not long after this, because he had just been fired from the World Wrestling Federation for a dress code violation. I don't know if Vince was running Catholic school or what he was doing, but that's what was said, although I'm sure that there's more to that than meets the eye. The finisher for this match by Masa Saito is a sharpshooter, which they call an Indian deathlock, which I'm just, you know, slapping my forehead there with Rod Trongon. And Saito, he's so great. He's a guy I would not mess with. He's reached Haku status in the times that I've seen him. And as I mentioned before, my introduction to him as a wrestler was actually him winning the AWA title. So I worked completely backwards and didn't find out about any of the 80s stuff because it didn't turn up on any of the Coliseum videos that I could rent in my area. And I'm just wondering if he and Haku ever hung out together. They both had run-ins with authority figures, both with police. I know Haku had a thing in Baltimore in 1988. I feel like they have a lot in common. That would have been one hell of a tag team at some point along the line. After the match, they list the top five contenders to the tag team championship held by the Midnight Rockers. Number one is, as I mentioned, Super Ninja and Saito. Number two is Mr. Magnificent Kevin Kelly and Buddy Rose, who was actually gone by this point. He was subbed out on the Super Clash card. Number three is Zukov and Blaster, as I wrote here. I don't even remember what that was, but it's not even Zukov and Ustinov. Whatever. Number four is the Blonde Bombers of Nick Bockwinkel and Ray Stevens. And number five is DJ Peterson and Kurt Hennig. So you can see, not a lot of depth in the promotion. They had to double up with guys from the singles in the tag teams just to fill out a top five. I mean, maybe just do a top three next time.
A lot of people know about hitting somebody with a pair of brass knucks. Well, if you put a roll of coins inside your hand, it makes it just like a rock. That's the reason fighters, they tape their fists, they're harder. And it was quite obvious when Ray Stevens grabbed his hand, it was more than 60 cents, Larry Zbysko. It looked more like a whole roll of something to me. Now, I don't care who wins a world title, whether if it be Kurt Hennig or whether if it be Nick Bockwinkel. I'd love to have a chance at either one of them. But I'm glad I won my match, and I want to wrestle all over the world, all over the country. I'm planning on going to Georgia wrestling. I'm going to be in Murrieta the 24th, not to wrestle, but I'm going to watch a great card.
That was Jerry Blackwell, who was coming off a victory over Boris Zukov at Super Clash 2, explaining why you would put a coins in somebody's hands and, you know, the purpose of wrist tape. Although, as I understand it, it's more of a to keep the stability of one's wrist or hand by taping it up rather than, you know, an intention to inflict pain on somebody, which, I don't know, maybe it works here, whatever. It's interesting how he's like, I'm going back to Marietta, but just to watch. Like, well, he is built from Stone Mountain, Georgia, so there he goes. And there are actually no results for him over the next 3 months. I don't know if he got hurt, if he's taking time off or whatever. Seems like kind of a bad time for him to do that, considering that with Kurt Hennig turning heel, you don't really have much in the way of baby faces, especially with Nick Bockwinkel about to retire, which they may or may not have known at that time. When he did come back in August, he would team with Wahoo McDaniel to face the original Midnight Express, Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose. That's a match I would certainly love to see. And Rod says that the title will be decided in the next day or so, which is interesting because later in this show, he has Bockwinkel there and Stanley Blackburn, and he's unsure of the time frame and has to check. And speaking of the original gangsta, you got Nick Bockwinkel up next with Pete Sanchez, and he has the belt, and he gets kind of a mixed reaction from the Las Vegas crowd. No music for Nick Bockwinkel, but we all know what his real music would be. You know, he feels good to be a gangsta. But for some reason, in spite of all of his experience being a gangsta, he turns his back on his opponent, Pete Sanchez. And as he just kind of walks to the corner, and Sanchez works him over for a while. And as a wise man once said, you come at the king, you best not miss. And by the way, don't reach out to me for any wire quotes or whatever. That's about as far as I go with that show, because people have told me to watch it so many times that I've just become irritated. Especially people who won't watch Mad Men in return. Just kind of drives me crazy. At this point, Rod Trongard kind of goes in a different direction and starts praising the production of the staff led by Sandy Chanley, who 10 years later ended up winning an Emmy as a producer on the Chris Rock comedy special Bring the Pain. So that's kind of a wrestling-oriented name there. And she produced a number of different things over the years, including Curb Your Enthusiasm, but mainly a specialist in comedy specials. You go through the IMDb page, a lot of various comedy specials over a decade to her credit. And the fact that she's producing AWA Wrestling here, the only complaint that I really have is they often would shoot with the other cameraman within view of the camera. That's a no-no that they try to avoid now, where when you're shooting something, you don't want to have another camera person in the shot. It's something you don't really want. Now, Bach fires up, gets some shots in on Sanchez, throws him, shoots him out of the ring. So very aggressive there. And Ron Francis said that Bachwinkle has wrestled on every continent. To which I say, that is bullshit, because Nick Bockwinkel has never defended the AWA title in Antarctica. I mean, sometimes Minnesota in January and February could probably feel like Antarctica, but he's never actually defended the title there. You can go to Antarctica, you just have to reserve it a long time in advance, like 3 years or something like that. Yeah, I think you leave from like Chile or something like that. Probably never going to happen for me. And figure four by Rod Trongard, and I actually made a mistake earlier, the sharpshooter that Saito locked in, he did not call it the Indian Deathlock then. I misremembered that, and as Roger Clemens would say, the Indian Death, he calls this an Indian Deathlock, and Bockwinkel applies the figure four in almost like a Hogan-like fashion, where he kind of steps over the leg rather than doing the spinning toe hold and then falling down with it. So I thought that was interesting. By doing it that way, you open yourself up. You can't really get pulled into a small package the way you would for, you know, doing the figure four the conventional way. His last date on record with the AWA is August 2nd in Oshkosh Bagosh, Wisconsin. That's the name of the children's clothing store. It's Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And then he turns up in the WWF shortly after that on an MSG show where he's welcomed by his former manager, Bobby Heenan, and he joins Gorilla Monsoon for commentary. And that was a real treat. The rare shows where Nick Bockwinkel was on commentary, I thought he was very good. It was kind of a fresh voice. He had been listening to Lord Al and all those guys for years and years and years. And now you have a guy who had been wrestling at the very top level for an extremely long period of time. And apparently it just wasn't his thing. He just didn't enjoy doing it or whatever, and became an agent later on. As I always have said, when I've mentioned his agent work, he takes a suplex from the Ultimate Warrior at the Royal Rumble in 89 when he starts beating up all of the agents, which is very sad to see. It kind of makes you think maybe Nick Bockwinkel should have, you know, just gone with the tide here and signed with Death Row Records. And if you're not down with Death Row as a staff, a record label, as a crew, then fuck you too.
Place to be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaySpeedNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySpeedNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and historyofwrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySpeedNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We hope you're enjoying the updates from Super Clash 2. In fact, I know you're enjoying the updates from Super Clash 2.
Well, that went from I hope to an absolute certainty in a hurry, Larry Nelson. Who the hell are you to tell me what I am and am not enjoying? I don't know how much I am enjoying this. I'm doing the show on it, so I'm stuck with it for now. Next bout is actually something that is joined in progress, and it is the AWA Women's Champion Sherry Martel taking on Despina Montagues. I probably am saying the name wrong, and I should apologize for that, as she would go on to marry Tarzan Godo, the guy from FMW who would have exploding steel cage matches and so on with Atsushi Onita. So, kind of an interesting backstory for her there. But our star of the match, which was actually taped on March 28th, is Sherry Martel, and she's, as I said, still the women's champion in the AWA. And you might be wondering, well, she goes to the WWF really soon. Who does she drop the title to? Medusa Michelli or somebody else? No, she doesn't actually drop the title at all. She leaves, and then they have the title vacant before Medusa picks it up very late in the year. That's actually not the only time it would happen in the AWA in 1987, because Boris Zukov would jump to the WWF late in the year before the Survivor Series, and he would have to vacate half of the tag team titles and kind of hand it over to, they just gave it to Doug Summers and pretended that nothing was wrong. Now, Sherry, her jump was in July, and she debuted in Houston against the Fabulous Moolah as, I want to say, a de facto babyface, because just the concept of the Fabulous Moolah as the babyface in any match, like at Survivor Series 87, just absolutely blows my mind, and I'll never quite understand that. She wins the WWF Women's title in her debut match, just like Paige. However, her career in the WWF would, you know, be a little bit longer and a little bit more successful, I think, than what Paige's has been. Maybe a little bit less infamous as well. Martel, as a wrestler, I have a couple theories about her from this time, because when you think of the Sensational Sherry, you probably think of her most as a manager in the WWF, especially for Randy Savage. Yeah, she's with Ted DiBiase, and she's with Shawn Michaels later on, and then more in WCW with Harlem Heat and all that. And Martel goes out after Despina, who I'm just going to call her Despina because that's a lot easier to say. And by the way, our empty seat in the front row update, there was only two when it was joined in progress, but when Martel goes out after her on the floor, I'm counting maybe there's seats on the side, so now we're up to five empty seats. Then they get back in a rolling cradle for two by Sherry. And as she's on offense, she's fairly deliberate, and she's smiling, like a kind of like a sadistic smile. And certainly no arguing that Sherry was a terrific heel, which, I mean, you had to get the, if you wanted to get the title from Fabulous Moolah to Sherry, you probably had to do it right away, because if Sherry was going to be a heel long term, you can't really do the heel versus heel match later. You got to get it out of the way right then. Sherry's clothesline isn't all that great, but I don't think there were a lot of women's wrestlers in the United States that were pulling off good-looking clotheslines at that time. And then Sherry gets hit with one as well, and Despina goes into the annoying hair snapmares that were a staple of the Fabulous Moolah matches. She was actually trained by Moolah and debuted in 1984, so she had to be probably one of the last ones that would come along. And is sent to the outside, and then eventually she gets a two count. Now, Sherry as a worker, I think, just in looking at her, she is not anything like what we see today. I mean, and that's kind of an unfair expectation when you watch her in a match. My theory, given how good she was as a manager in 1989 and the way she was willing to just throw herself out there and bump, maybe it is her opponents in this case. She's facing the same opponents over and over again. But the bottom line is, I think Sensational Sherry as an actual professional wrestler is probably bored as hell after a while. You know, how many times can you face Candy Devine before you just become totally sick of it? I mean, that's not a knock on anybody, but if you're facing the same opponent, it's very hard to keep it fresh and keep it interested. I mean, that's why it's amazing that the Jumping Bomb Angels and the Glamour Girls could have had, you know, as good a series of matches as they could, because they were literally the only opponents that they had for each other in late 87, early 88, WWF. So when she goes to WWF and becomes Peggy Sue with, like, the whole wig getup and all that, kind of as a ringside presence, I think that was probably refreshing for her. The fact that she actually got to do something else for a change. And then once she becomes the manager for Randy Savage after WrestleMania 5, well, I don't want to say, you know, light the rocket to her, but I mean, she's now managing a main event star when before she had not managed anybody. Now here, she hits Despina with a low blow, which I'm not going to, you know, I'm not a gynecologist, but I'm not sure exactly how that would work or anything. And get a slingshot by Sherry where her opponent, Despina, she goes over the top rope. So it's an instant disqualification. And my God, what a crappy finish this was, where Sherry regains control and then just immediately gets herself DQ'd for no real reason. Just an absolute dog shit of a finish. In the AWA, I can't believe that they did a terrible finish in the AWA in a title match. This is definitely a first.
Look at this! And she throws it up and over and out, and is going to be disqualified. Sherry Martel is going to lose this match, Russ Francis, but she is not going to lose the championship belt.
They've talked about changing that rule. Anytime there's an intentional, and the fans don't like it either. Anytime an intentional move like that to regain the championship.
Yeah, Russ Francis kind of trailed off there, but maybe a point he was trying to make is to make the DQ rule kind of like intentional grounding in football, where the quarterback can't just throw the ball away while he's in the pocket. Or at least that's how the rule is now. I forget how it was back in 87. They're probably probably everything was intentional grounding back then, because there was not much protection of quarterbacks. So anyway, to our next bout, we have the Midnight Rockers, and it is only fitting that the boy toy, Shawn Michaels, should follow Sherry on this program. And they are taking on the team of Brian Knobbs. So yes, we have the two nasty boys on the show, but in completely separate matches. And Mike Richards. And this is not Kramer from Seinfeld. It is not the Mike Richards who played for the Flyers, Kings, and Capitals, who got into trouble with oxycodone without a prescription at the U.S.-Canadian border and had his very long contract terminated back in 2015, as much as Marty Jannetty might want that to be so. Now, I don't want to make too many cheap shots at Marty Jannetty, because I believe I had mentioned earlier, he had a match with Joey Janela last week in an independent show in Ohio. I think it was AIW. And apparently Marty was really hurt and he gutted his way through the match. And Joey Janela says he's going to do like a fundraiser, a Kickstarter or whatever to pay for some of the surgeries that Marty Jannetty is going to need at some point down the road. So, you know, keep an eye out for that as we go forward there. There was a bad table spot in that match, like almost Harley Race-esque, where the table didn't break, and Janela, it really looked like it was not good for either guy. Janela, being younger, will probably be much easier for him to recover from it. Now, the Rockers, they're off to the WWF in a month, and it's May 25th in Lake Tahoe that they lose the tag team titles to the Russians. They show up early June, WWF, where they have two nights of tapings for Superstars of Wrestling and Wrestling Challenge. One night in Buffalo, New York, which I actually covered episode 49, the infamous June 13th, 1987 show in Buffalo, where the Honky Tonk Man beats Ricky Steamboat for the Intercontinental title. Then the next night in Rochester, they taped for Challenge. They actually wrestled on the Challenge taping, I believe it was actually either one or the other. However, right before that was when Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Iron Sheik had their little thing in New Jersey, the death of kayfabe, as it were, or, you know, really officially, because it was national news. So there was a new effort by Vince where he gives a speech to the talent. Stay off, well, not all drugs, but at least cocaine. Yeah, please, no cocaine or anything like that. Try to keep yourself under control. No hard partying. Now, that wasn't going to fly with the Midnight Rockers of mid-1987. They just could not abide by that. So they go out and immediately get fired for partying like idiots. And some of it may have been out of their control, it seems, from the various stories that I've read. I mean, I'm not going to go through all of them, but they're all out there. I think one of them has to do with, like, Jimmy Jack Funk or whatever. So, but now on play-by-play for this show, we still have Rod Trongard, but we also have Nick Bockwinkel joining the commentary team. So I do get a little bit of a treat here. That this is nice. As for the empty seats front row opposite hard camera watch, we are still at 7. So they're just not going to do a damn thing about that. And Knobs actually starts out in this match, and some fairly normal offense to start out, arm drag, drop kick. Then Knobs locks Jannetty in a wrist lock, and to get out of it, Marty kind of does that thing where he walks the rope, slingshots both legs off the top rope, flips over, and gets out of it that way. Now, fairly commonplace in the last 30 years. I mean, you've seen it probably a million times, but you have to put yourself in the shoes of the person at the time, sitting in the Showboat in 1987. Not just even all promotions, but for the AWA, that is pretty revolutionary stuff. You just get the sense that they're not long for this promotion. Like, okay, they need to go someplace bigger because they're clearly a cut above what you usually see here. And even Bockwinkel is like, I've never seen that before, and I've wrestled everywhere, so that'll tell you something. And this, I don't know what the, okay, so Trongard says, the Rockers are not afraid to experiment, and I just wrote, yeah, with drugs, or whatever. So Knobs does get some shots in on Marty, but then tags out to Richards, so we kind of know what's coming here. And Irish whip, but there's a tag to Michaels and drop down, and Michaels scores with a drop kick. And then Richards puts, he regains some semblance of control, but then goes for a backdrop. He just puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. I feel like that move hasn't happened on recent shows that I've done. Michaels actually leapfrogs over it and then scores with a backslide, which gets a two count, but then Richards rakes the eyes to put Michaels in a little bit of peril again, but he does make a tag to Jannetty, who eventually Irish whips Richards and makes a blind tag to Shawn, I guess really not so much of a blind tag to Shawn Michaels, who goes up to the top rope, and as Richards is coming in, a flying body press by Shawn ends up picking up the win for the Midnight Rockers here on AWA Pro Wrestling. Well, probably has to be one of their last TV appearances since they only got about a month left. Maybe two or three matches if they're thrown on TV every week. And the question I have for them is, was it for the best that they got fired? And this is another one of those butterfly effect things that the Rockers in 87 WWF. It seems obvious that eventually they would feud with the Hart Foundation. As Bret Hart in his book had said, that he was disappointed that these guys got themselves canned so quickly because they needed a fresh opponent, because the Hart Foundation versus the British Bulldogs had really run its course. The fact that Dynamite Kid was practically crippled, so to have these new guys that come in, maybe they could have had some great matches there. But it might have been for the best that they got fired, because a message was sent that, well, you need to clean yourself up a little bit. Maybe not clean yourself up, but, you know, don't try to mature at least a little bit here, which clearly they did since they were brought back a year later. But to think of them in 87, they may have ended up just taking the place of the Can-Am Connection, assuming everything goes the same, where Tom Zenk walks out, and then they slide into that spot and eventually win the tag team titles from the Hart Foundation at the end of the year. So once again, from the Rockers getting fired, I think this might actually be the case that Tito Santana, once again, who had nothing going on and ends up being part of Strike Force, is all of this. Tito Santana, actually the big winner of the Rockers getting fired so quickly for the WWF. At least that's what I think, and it's pretty amazing how Tito just kept benefiting from all that.
This is a Nation's Business Update with Merrill Comer.
Yes, this was an ESPN show, Nation's Business Update with Merrill Comer. Aired on ESPN from November of 1985 to September of 91. It was an hour-long business news program that would air from 6:30 to 7:30 Eastern each morning, and then would air again the following hour, 7:30 to 8:30. And this is something, even though it was on for nearly 6 years, I had no recollection. Now, it's probably because it goes off the air when I'm 12, and I would have no interest in business news like this. But ESPN was a little different in the 80s. They used to show a lot more, you know, a lot of sports that you wouldn't ordinarily see. A lot of that Australian rules football stuff going on. And then eventually, when the 90s came around, they started to get rights to things. They had gotten the NFL for Sunday nights for half the season in the late 80s, and they got MLB. But ESPN, completely different place in the 80s. I mean, noted by the fact that they allowed the AWA on their airwaves, including a guy with a fucking swastika on his arm. I cannot stress that enough. So Merrill Comer checks in with some news.
GM's catalog division has unveiled its new 88 models while predicting lower than expected sales results for 1987.
In 87, they had rolled out the Cadillac Elante, and to kind of mixed results, it was a vehicle that they wanted to price in like the luxury class, and people at that time were not comfortable paying top flight prices like that you would pay for a BMW or something for a Cadillac or any sort of domestic made car. Cadillac sales are actually 287,000 or 261,000 in 87, which was significantly down from 304,000 the year before. My initial thought was that maybe mobsters were just hurting in 87, or maybe they just wanted to stick with the models that they had. Maybe the trunk sizes were too small in the 87 models.
General Mills reports a 28% increase in first quarter income.
You know, when I was a kid, I ate my share of cereal, but I didn't eat that much cereal that I would have been single-handedly responsible for a 28% jump for General Mills.
And today, Congresswoman Pat Schroeder said she will not seek the 1988 Democratic presidential nomination.
Now, much like my wife, you may have forgotten about Pat Schroeder, former congresswoman from Colorado for 24 years from 1973 to 1997. Yeah, she did have a brief flirtation with running for president in 1988. The thing about that is I can actually now pinpoint the date of when this tape would have aired or whatever, and it's actually September 29th, 1987. So this AWA show is from May, but you know, they would often just show things months later, I guess, on ESPN. I think the Wrestle Rock show from last week may have been pulled from September of 86 also, because sometimes you can tell by the little ticker at the bottom of the screen that brings up like the scores. Somebody has pointed that out to me in the past. And Pat Schroeder was actually the chairwoman of the Gary Hart for President campaign. No, not the manager, Gary Hart. The Gary Hart who got caught with multiple floozies back in 87. And she had eventually decided to run. And this is after her dropping out is right after Joe Biden dropped out in 1988 for basically stealing British politician named Neil Kinnock's entire gimmick and life story. But that's neither here nor there. But Pat actually criticized the process and the system that leads to how we choose our presidents, that maybe it's not attracting the best people. And she was right, because the way that it is set up, you're only going to attract the most egomaniacal people, at least I think. And, you know, and that's kind of been borne out by some of our presidents over the last 25 or 30 years. I mean, some have been better people than others, but I don't think we're getting the best of the best to be president of the United States. She also coined the term the Teflon president of Ronald Reagan while she was making eggs. And that's not a joke about her. But if I am going to make a joke about her, it's the fact that her name is an amalgam of Peppermint Patty and Schroeder from Peanuts. Get a couple of ads tacked on in this show. One for a fabric relaxer, which does that thing you see in a lot of commercials where it gets like really, really close to the fabric and shows how the spray affects the individual fibers in one shirt. I enjoy that, along with like the Mucinex family and all that. I mean, yeah, that is a little gross, but you know, how are you going to really advertise for something that's, you know, to get rid of your snot? I mean, let's face it here. Then there's an ad for Silver Eagle Records, which I was excited about because I thought it was going to be one of those Time Life deals of like singer-songwriters of the 70s or something, where you get like a bunch of Jim Croce and Dan Fogelberg songs or something. But this is actually TNT. It's not Tuesday Night Titans. It's not Turner Network Television. Instead, it's The Temptations and the Tops, meaning the Four Tops. And it's just a collection of the hits of those two bands. So nothing too special there. I mean, if you're familiar with their music. And then an ad for games coming up on ESPN that weekend, which, as I said, this is September of 87 that the footage here is pulled from. So these games took place the first weekend of October in 87. We have Nebraska playing South Carolina, and Nebraska emerged victorious in that one by a score of 30-21. Nebraska's football program, well, I was never really a fan. I didn't particularly care for how they were handed the 1997 AP national title, considering that the only reason they were undefeated was because of a play where they clearly cheated against Missouri, where the ball goes off. It goes off a guy's leg, but he kicked the ball to another receiver so that he could make the winning catch. If that doesn't happen on fourth down, well, they end up losing the game and there's no debate. So that should have been considered when comparing them with the legitimately undefeated Michigan team. And number 19 Florida took on number 7 LSU, and LSU won that game 13-10. The Florida Gators that year had a freshman running back by the name of Emmitt Smith, who would go on to do a few things in the NFL for the Dallas Cowboys and, I guess, the Arizona Cardinals. I mean, do I have to say that Emmitt Smith played for the Arizona Cardinals? I mean, it's kind of like, oh, Bobby Orr played part of his career with the Chicago Blackhawks. I mean, it's like, did that really even happen? Or like Babe Ruth played for the Boston Braves. I mean, it doesn't really matter. But back to Nebraska, though, they won 9 games every year. 9 games every year from 1969 to 2001. That's 33 consecutive years. Now, I know that they would often load up their non-conference schedule with patsies and so forth, but still, that's pretty impressive considering the most games you're playing at that time in college football was 12, so you're winning 75% of your games every year for 33 years.
Super Clash 2 here at the Cow Palace in San Francisco, California. Not without its controversy. Nick Bockwinkel, is he or isn't he the heavyweight champion of the world?
Standing with Rod Trongard is the original gangsta, Nick Bockwinkel, who I'll get to in a second, and the Grim Reaper himself, of at least of babyface title victories, I think, the original heel authority figure, Mr. Stanley Blackburn, who at this time was either 69 or 70 years old. He passed away at the age of 80 in 1997. And I have to say that if they had had a pageant for like the dumpiest looking guy who appeared on TV at least semi-regularly in the mid-80s, he might have actually won that. I'm not going to say too much bad about him because apparently he's close to the Funk family and Terry Funk, I guess, knew him since he was 4 years old. So I guess I'll kind of lay off him as, you know, the guy that they would throw out there to make these horribly unpopular decisions to either keep the title on a heel or hand the title over to Nick Bockwinkel or something to that effect. Well, Bockwinkel, he gets his say first, and he's got like a towel around his neck. He's got his arms crossed, almost like Taz would do in 1998-99, just standing in the corner. And Bockwinkel, you could just read his face. Like, he just does not give a fuck anymore. Like, just looking into his eyes, he's like, I'd just rather be anywhere else than here. I've been here 2 decades, and I'm still dealing with this shit of just screwy finishes where nobody, it seems, to know what they're doing, especially Vern. I got to plot my way out. I've got to get out of here in the next few months. And sure enough, as I mentioned, he would. But before he does that, he's got a few things to say. And like before, it's come at the king and you best not miss.
Well, I'm settled down. I guess I'm not going to be so vocal and vulgar, but I was a little bit hot at the moment. I'm just totally amazed at surprisingly that Mr. Zbyszko seemingly wants to get up and encourage Curt Hennig. Zbyszko doesn't do anything to encourage anyone. Curt Hennig, the theme here is that Curt Hennig was given something by Zbyszko, and my lights went out. And I can only tell you this. I'm going to have to wait for the championship committee. I don't like the idea. I don't like losing this way. If that's the way I'm going to be losing, I don't mind. If I got pinned right in the middle of the ring, that's another thing. But I'm sure I'm going to have to just sit back and wait like everybody else. It is in the hands of Stanley Blackburn and the championship committee.
Okay, fair enough. It's out of his hands. He doesn't get too angry about it or anything like that. So we got Stanley Blackburn there. And Rod opens the line of questioning. This is hilarious.
Stanley, you and I saw it from just about the same vantage point. The decision is in your hands. Exactly what are you going to be doing?
Not entirely in my hands.
Trongard has absolutely no idea what is going on around him. It's like, ironically, because he's wearing sunglasses all the time, that he's the sun and just all these planets are going on around him. He's none the wiser about what's going on.
It's in the hands of the championship committee. It's the 6 promoters are on that committee, and I only vote in case of a tie. We're going to all look over the film and the tape of it and make our decision in the next few days.
Is there any time length at all that you can tell us? How long might it be other than the next few days, tomorrow, the day after?
The next few days would be 3 or 4 days, something like that.
So he says in the next few days, and Trongard wants him to say, well, do you have any sort of time frame? Like, the next few days. It's what he just said, Rod. He's just not paying attention to what is going on around him at all. And by the way, a few episodes back, Nick Bockwinkel, as the commissioner of World Championship Wrestling, had presided over a vote to reinstate Ric Flair. This is the WCW Saturday Night, or excuse me, WCW Pro from April of 1995 that I covered a few episodes back. And it ended up in a 2-2 with one person abstaining tie, and Bockwinkel was not there to break the tie. He didn't vote either way. So Bockwinkel learned nothing from this experience, although, to be fair, it's that he had a committee of 5 people, and how the hell was he going to know that that woman was going to just abstain for whatever reason it was that she gave? But this vote ended up being 4-2 to give the title to Curt Hennig, saying that there was no evidence of interference in the match, which It's just absolutely hilarious, given, you know, you could see it on the TV. You can say, oh, well, the referee's decision is final. Maybe do something like that. But, of course, you can't say that in the AWA because they're always looking for ways to bullshit their way out of finishes. Now you've got the world title on a heel again, and you've got to keep that open so you can screw a babyface at some point down the line. And you wonder why this promotion went under just a few years down the road, despite having this presence on ESPN. It's really kind of amazing, just the series of bad decisions, like one after the other. It didn't seem like they were making any really good decisions on like a major level from, let's say, 80, right here in 87, all the way up to the very end. As a kid, and maybe, you know what, I'm going to save my thoughts on the Team Challenge series for another time, for when I decide to return and do another AWA show, because I remember seeing that in the After magazines, and I actually did have an opinion on it as a kid at the time, although I didn't get to see much of it because it was so sporadic on ESPN by that point. It's just kind of, you know, an infuriating situation, all of this. But luckily for us, we have Rod Trongard, the great journalist, wrapping things up with the final stand-up, as it's known in the broadcast business. Basically just reiterating what the situation is with Henning and Bockwinkel for those of you who happen to have this television on but have been in a coma for the last 40 minutes. So in case you missed it, you got good old Rod Trongard to break it down with his sunglasses indoors. And that is how they wrap on AWA Wrestling for May 9th, 1987. It occurred to me while recording this episode that it has now been 1 year exactly since I had joined the Pro Wrestling Only feed as part of Place to Be Nation. And instead of doing something like a YouTube commentator, and by the way, there's only one YouTube comment, or any of the other vanity stuff that you allow me to do at the end of each episode of Greetings from Allentown, I just want to say thank you to a number of people for, you know, I know I already did a one-year anniversary show, but this is 1 year for me as part of the network. And the first person I have to thank is Kelly Nelson, one of the titans of wrestling, and for pulling me out of obscurity. I do recall getting a DM from him on Twitter while I was at a Red Sox-Orioles game that the Orioles actually won. That's how long ago that was. And he's the one who's mostly responsible for pulling me from relative obscurity and giving me a larger platform. And you can thank him by listening to WorldCast every Wednesday on this Pro Wrestling Only feed, although I think they're actually doing an offshoot show this week covering something else. You never know what they might do, but in terms of covering World Class, they are on to the Freebirds now, so things are about to pick up. Also have to thank Chad Campbell of Where the Big Boys Play and also Wrestling Warzone, which you can hear on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, along with Brad Warren, who kind of guided me through those first days on the network. I posted my shows the first many times out right after I joined the feed, and just kind of their guiding influence and whatnot. Also, JT Rosero and Scott Crisolo for giving me a platform on their podcast, the Place to Be podcast, including this week as the Saturday Night's Main Event specialist. I like to think that, you know, I'm kind of the network TV guru on there, and it's a lot of fun chatting with them when that comes up. Graham Cawthon of the History of WWE.com, because without that website, doing this show would be way more difficult than it is, and it just makes it so much easier to have all that stuff in one place to be able to provide the sort of context that I'm looking to present to you. And it's also like the many podcast pals I've made, since I've started this show back February of 2017, Joe Morata and Michael Quinn of the Our Vantage Point podcast, who I mention every week, and they're always very good to me and make sure to plug my show, along with the wrestling podcast About Nothing, Mike Crockett and Ring of Honor's Brian Malonis, and also my sometimes podcast partner, Steve Bennett of the Sportscasters. As you know, we've teamed up for a couple of Adams Division podcasts, one of them covering WrestleManias 1 through 14, and the other one covering his top 100 greatest WWE wrestler ever list that came out earlier this year. And also, thank you to everyone who is a fan of this show, who listens to this show, whether I've interacted with you or not, if you've sent an email, a tweet, or whatever. You know, there's so many of you to name, but I'll have to make sure to name Keith Langston, the voice of Greetings from Allentown, because he was the original fan of this show. And I'm just glad that you enjoy this bizarre outlet that I have for these random musings there, where I can sit in my basement next to a balsam candle, huffing it on occasion, where I could just talk about stupid stuff like Pat Schroeder and all that, while somehow maintaining the facade of it being a wrestling podcast, because I do enjoy talking about that too. If I didn't, I wouldn't have gotten to 67 episodes now. So, you know, I just wanted to get that out there. I know I said a heartfelt thank you last week, but I wanted to make sure that this one was a little bit more sober, because I like gulped down a bourbon before I said my thank yous last week. I was like a little manic, even for me, a guy who was nicknamed Manic Pete by my floor mates my sophomore year at Boston University. So thank you so much for listening to the show. Now, as for next week, I have a show planned for 68, and I actually intended for this show to be number 68 a while ago, and I was provided video on this by a very special benefactor. I'm kind of talking like Brother Love there, because it was something that happened on the Brother Love show. Be looking at WWF Superstars of Wrestling from October 22nd, 1988. A episode most famous for its Brother Love show segment with special guest Hulk Hogan, where he is ambushed by the big man from Cobb County, Georgia, the Big Boss Man, and kicking off what, if you had told somebody at that moment that that guy in the blue uniform and the cool outfit and all that would be one of Hulk Hogan's best opponents, both in the ring and from a financial perspective, I'm not sure how many people would have necessarily believed you or taken you seriously when you told them that. So I'll get into all that next week. A lot else with the fall of 1988 WWF to cover. And tune in then, next Thursday, for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.